Well, most people mistakenly call it Linux. But that's actually not what I'm going to talk about today. Today I'm going to be talking about an issue that is of tremendous importance to anyone that hopes to develop or distribute or use software. And that is the danger of software idea patents. Patents covering software ideas. To understand what these patents do, the first step is to get rid of a confusing concept that you may have heard called, quote, intellectual property, unquote. It used to be that people knew there were several specific laws. For instance, there was patent law, and there was copyright law, and there was trademark law. And each of these laws applied to a different thing and made different requirements and had a different purpose. So they actually had nothing in common. And when people considered the issues raised by these laws, they would look at the specifics of a particular law in order to come up with a thoughtful conclusion. But then, companies that tended to be the beneficiaries of these laws started to distort the public consideration of them by promulgating another term, the term, quote, intellectual property, unquote, which lumps together these three laws and various others that are also different and talks about them in a biased way. You see, it used to be that we knew that the purpose of patent law was to promote progress, and that the purpose of copyright was to promote creativity, and that the purpose of trademark law wasn't to promote anything, it was just so buyers could know what they were buying. And so each law would be considered in terms of its own specific purpose as a method of providing benefit for the public, because that's all that these purposes have in common, is their benefits for the public, not for private parties. They're a public interest. People understood that each of these laws was intended to serve the public and that it should be designed to serve the public well with little burden. But the term intellectual property assumes that they have a very different purpose, that their purpose is to be a privilege for certain parties that deserve to be treated better than everyone else. That we're supposed to imagine that patents exist for the sake of patent holders, and that copyrights exist for the sake of copyright holders, and trademarks exist for the sake of trademark holders. And if we judge these issues from the wrong premises, everything we conclude will be foolish. So that's the bias in the term. That comes from the word property. We're supposed to forget that these are artificial monopolies that were imposed by the government for the sake of the public, and we're supposed to consider them as some kind of natural right that we have to recognize no matter how much harm it does. The bias is pretty easy to see. It's a little harder to recognize that there's an even worse problem in the overgeneralization of this term. By lumping together patent law and copyright law, which have nothing in common, and then lumping them together with trademark law that has nothing in common with either of them, it invites people to stop thinking about the issues of patent law and the completely different issues of copyright law and the completely different issues of trademark law, and instead to try to have an opinion about intellectual property. That's about as dumb as if we started discussing the issues of Asian society and forgetting that India and China and Japan and Thailand are all different. Well, we're not likely to actually forget that. Enough people know that China is not like India and Japan isn't like either one of them. We can use the word Asia and nobody's going to forget that these countries are really very different. But people don't know mostly that much about patent law or copyright law or trademark law. And as far as they know, intellectual property really is a coherent thing, and they believe that they can have opinions about it. And any opinion about something as overbroad as intellectual property is going to be foolish. So people ask me my opinion about it, I say, I don't have one, and you shouldn't either. It's not a coherent subject. If you try to think about, quote, the issue of intellectual property, unquote, you've already gone wrong. So here I'm going to be talking about the issue of patent law when it's applied to the field of software. And this effect follows from certain general things about patent law, which are very different from copyright law. So copyright law and patent law affect the software field in totally different ways. You see, a copyright covers a specific work. It covers the details of that work. So if you write a program and you write the code yourself, you or perhaps the employer you're doing it for have the copyright, nobody else. So you don't have to be afraid that you will write some code and it's copyrighted by some stranger that you've had nothing to do with. That can't happen, because copyright only covers copying. If you didn't copy the code written by that stranger, you can't infringe the copyright. So in general, copyright is not something that programmers have to be scared of. It's not going to get them sued for writing software. Patents, however, work totally differently, because a patent doesn't cover a program. This is not a matter of patents on programs. That term is misleading. It's not a matter of patenting programs, because these patents do not cover a single program. Each of these patents covers an idea, a technique, a method, an algorithm, a feature, some kind of computation that might be done in a program. But it's a trivial program that does only one thing. If you wrote a toy exercise in your first year programming class, maybe it only does one thing. Real programs, large programs, do thousands of things. They combine thousands of ideas, which means that hundreds of them are probably patented, and if you write a program, you're asking to get sued. Writing a program that combines thousands of ideas is laying yourself open to hundreds of different patent infringement lawsuits. The only important things about copyright and patents in the field of software is how they are different. The effect of copyright on software is to restrict the distribution of a program by people other than its author. The effect of patents on software ideas is to restrict software developers and the authorized users of the same software, because the users can get sued too. If performing a certain kind of computation on a computer is patented, and you develop a program, and somewhere in this program is that computation, not only you can get sued, but all your users can get sued too, one by one, or together. When people describe how the patent system works, usually they have a vested interest in the system. Either they are patent lawyers, or they work for the patent office, or they work in the patent department of a large company. So they describe the system from a biased point of view, making it sound good. The magazine The Economist once compared the patent system to, quote, a time-consuming lottery, unquote. I'm sure if you've ever seen the publicity for a lottery, you know how it works. They focus all the attention on a rather unlikely possibility that you win, and they ignore the overwhelmingly likely probability that you lose. And in this way, without ever telling an out-and-out lie, they present a half-truth that's designed to give people the wrong idea. That's the way the publicity for the patent system works. Those people with a vested interest, they present the system from the point of view of someone who is getting a patent, and then they explain what it's like to walk down the street with a patent in your pocket, and every so often you can pull it out and point it at somebody and say, "Give me your money." So to make up for their imbalance, I'm going to describe what the system looks like from the other end, from the viewpoint of those who want to develop software or use software. What it's like to walk down the street knowing that anybody you meet might pull a patent out of his pocket and point it at you and say, "Give me your money." So suppose you want to write a program and you're in a country that is foolish enough to allow software ideas to be patented. What do you do? What should you do so as to avoid getting sued or avoid having your project shut down using patents? Well, one thing you might try to do is find all the possibly patented ideas that are used in your program. This is nearly impossible. And the reason is that any intellectual thing, any set of ideas, can be sliced in various ways. It could be sliced this way or this way or this way. And so if we look at the things the program actually does, there are many different ways of cutting them up and grouping them into things that someone might patent. And you won't be able to see them all, because in your design process, you saw them in a certain way. It's very hard to change, to take a totally fresh look and realize that the various things in your program could have been grouped differently into other collections that might be patented. So you can't do that. Another thing you could try to do is to find all the patents that may someday prohibit this program. See, each patent is a government-issued absolute monopoly on the use of a certain idea described in the patent. So you could try to find all the patents that will restrict your program. You can't do that. And the reason is that patent applications are kept secret at least for 18 months, sometimes longer. And you can't find out what patents may be issued tomorrow or next year that will then prohibit the program you're about to release today. This is not just a theoretical danger. It's actually happened. For instance, in 1984, the Compress program was written. That was a program, free software as it happens, for data compression. And it used the LZW data compression algorithm, which the author had found in a journal. This was back when we thought that the point of having technical journals was to publish ideas that we could use in developing software. And in fact, in 1984, there was no patent on LZW. But in 1985, a U.S. patent was issued. The patent holder cunningly did not immediately warn the potential victims that they were in danger. Instead, the patent holder thought, or apparently thought, let's wait a while for them to dig their hole deeper and then we'll attack. By the late 80s, it was clear that one could not safely use Compress. And we were looking for another way to do the job. And someone wrote to me saying he had been developing a data compression program for a year and he had decided to give it to us, make it a GNU package. So we were about a week away from releasing that program when, just by luck, I saw the New York Times on the day of the weekly patents column. And this only happened a few times a year. And it said that somebody had got a patent for, quote, inventing a new way to compress data, unquote. And I thought, uh-oh, we better look at that. And sure enough, it covered the algorithm we were just about to release. That program died before it was born. But it could have been worse. That patent could have come out a week after the release, or 6 months after the release. Well, eventually, we found another data compression algorithm, the one used in GZIP, and it's actually faster and does better compression than LZW. And everyone who wanted to compress files pretty much switched to GZIP. So it sounds like a happy ending, but I'll tell you a bit more. It's not all so happy. I'll tell you more when I get to it. So you can't find out all the patents that are going to restrict your program in the future. But you could find all the issued patents, because those are published by the patent office. You could get the whole stack. If you were in the US, it would be a very tall stack. There are hundreds of thousands of software patents. So you can't study them all. What you're going to have to do is try to search for the ones that are relevant. And there are various ways to do that, and they work more or less. So you'll find a lot of relevant patents that restrict what you're doing in this program and might prohibit it completely. But there may be others you won't find. For instance, there was a patent in the US on natural order recalculation in spreadsheets, or rather I should say covering natural order recalculation in spreadsheets. This simply means that when it's time to recalculate, it does each cell after the ones it depends on. If you recalculate a cell before updating something it depends on, it'll be inconsistent. So they do it in the right order and everything's consistent. The first spreadsheets didn't do this. They did everything top to bottom because they ran in very small computers. Anyway, somebody asked me for a copy of that patent, so I looked in our files, found the number, pulled out this paper copy of the patent, Xeroxed it, and mailed it to him. And a week later, when he got it, he said, "I think you sent me the wrong patent. This is something about compiling." So I looked in the file, I pulled up the piece of paper, and yes, it said, "A method for compiling formulas into object code." So I thought, what happened? Did we record the wrong patent number for this? I started looking at that patent, and sure enough, it was a natural order recalculation patent, but it didn't mention spreadsheets, and it didn't mention natural order recalculation. The algorithm that's used to do this is known as topological sort. And in the claims of this patent, it listed dozens of different ways you could arrange a program to do topological sort. People are laughing because they know how fundamental and old and basic this algorithm is. So this patent covered dozens of different ways, every different way, he hopes, of doing topological sort. But it didn't mention the term topological sort. If you had been trying to search for this patent, you would not have found it. The only way you would have heard about it was if somebody else told you he was getting sued. But you'll find a lot of patents. And then what do? You have to figure out what they don't allow you to do. And that's hard because they're written in twisted legal language and the words don't mean what you think. 20 years ago, the Australian government did a study of the patent system. And the conclusion of this study was that there was no sign that having a patent system did Australia any good at all. And if not for international pressure, it would recommend abolishing the patent system. But given the international pressure, it recommended making patents narrower in scope, harder to get, and last a shorter period of time. And in particular, they said that patents were a complete failure at one of their stated goals, which was to publish information so people could understand it. And they said that very few of the engineers they had spoken to ever read a patent. And indeed, why would you work so hard to read something only to find out what you're not allowed to do? They quoted an engineer as saying, I can't recognize my own inventions in patentees. And I've seen that for myself. One Paul Heckel developed an interesting program which was designed to help people cram a lot of data onto a small screen. And based on ideas in that program, he got a couple of patents. Now, the patents, however, do not just cover the ideas that he presented in order to get a patent. They cover broader. They cover a broader range. Now, when he first, and that's normal, when he first saw a HyperCard, it didn't occur to him that it had anything to do with his patents because it didn't do the same thing his program did. But his lawyer said that the way the patents were written, they could be interpreted as covering HyperCard too. So he started threatening Apple, and when Apple did not immediately seem inclined to give him a lot of money, he started threatening Apple's customers. And eventually, Apple reached some kind of settlement with him, which is secret, so we don't know whether he managed to get away with a lot of booty or just a little. Once, when I was giving this speech, Heckel was in the audience, and at this point he jumped up and said, "That's not true. I just didn't understand the scope of my protection." And I said, "Yes, that's what I said." Perhaps if I had said no, he would have argued with me, but he didn't know how to argue with yes, so he just sat down again and kept his mouth shut. So that was my experience being heckled by Heckel. I'm not making any of this up. So you're going to have to spend a lot of time talking with a lawyer, explaining the various things you're thinking of doing in the program, and the lawyer will explain to you which of them are prohibited. Unfortunately, he will not be able to give you a clear, cut-and-dry answer. The lawyer will tell you something like this each time. If you do something in this area, you're almost certain to lose the lawsuit. If you do something in this area, there's a good chance you'll lose the lawsuit. And if you really want to be safe, stay out of this area. But keep in mind that there's a sizable element of chance in the outcome of any lawsuit. So now that you face clear and predictable rules for how to do business, what can you actually do? For each patent, there are three possibilities. You can avoid it, you can get a license for it, or you could overturn it, prove it's invalid. Each one of them, based on independent factors, may or may not be possible. So let's look at them one by one. First, to avoid the patent. That means don't use the idea that's covered by the patent. This may be easy or it may be hard. For instance, the LZW compression algorithm was patented, so we had to avoid it. Well, in the case of Compress, we avoided it by developing another superior data compression program using a different algorithm. So there, we successfully avoided the patent. But what about in PostScript? The specs of PostScript say that it has to have an operator for LZW compression and an operator for LZW uncompression. No other algorithm can possibly do the job unless it produces the same output. And no one has ever found a way to produce the same output with any other algorithm. So there was no way we could avoid this patent and still implement PostScript according to the spec. Well, we squeaked by just barely. It turns out users mostly don't ask their printer to compress. They ask their printer to uncompress. And the patent did not apply to programs that could only do uncompression. So we implemented the uncompression half. We did not implement the compression half. And even though this did not fully implement the spec, it implemented the part that users wanted. So we barely squeaked by. Now, what about GIF format? GIF format is also defined to use LZW compression. It didn't take long for people to design another format called PNG for pings not GIF, which uses the gzip compression algorithm. And we said to people, stop using GIF, switch to PNG format. And the users said, well, maybe someday, but the browsers don't support it. And the browser developer said, well, maybe someday, but the users aren't demanding it. Basically, the problem was that GIF had become a de facto standard, in effect a language that many people had started to speak. And it's very hard to persuade people to change to a different language. Imagine trying to persuade everyone in India to start speaking French. We were working against society's inertia. And even after more than 10 years of asking people to stop, even after having Burn All GIFs Day, you'll still see lots of GIF files and very few PNG files. Well, GIF was a fairly light case of this. There were only two patents covering GIF. Both of them covered the LZW data compression algorithm. In fact, the same algorithm had been patented twice. This is not supposed to happen. Supposedly, the patent office will only issue a patent for an idea that is new, useful, and unobvious. Practically speaking, they interpret that as meaning unobvious to somebody with an IQ of 80. But practically speaking, they can't even keep track. And there's a systematic reason why it's harder to keep track of software patents, because they're just covering pure math. It's just math. And math can be reformulated in different ways that superficially don't look alike. You have to study the two formulations carefully to recognize that they are really two formulations of the same thing. But patent examiners don't have the time to do that, so systematically they fail. This is not the only time I've seen a data compression algorithm get patented twice. Remember the program that died just before it was born? That algorithm was patented twice too. Apparently this happens pretty often. What does this lead us to? Well, for a while we thought that JPEG was a safe alternative. Now there's a patent suit. Somebody discovered that an old patent appears to cover JPEG, or so he says. And he's suing various companies for using JPEG format. Now, JPEG is not a de facto standard. It's an official standard. And the standards committee asked a lawyer to study this and reported that, in their opinion, that patent does not cover JPEG format. So who's right? The court will tell us, I guess. But that's also a fairly light case of the problem, just one patent covering the whole standard. What do you do when you want to when your program ought to support MPEG-2 video, and that's covered by 39 different U.S. patents at once? The negotiations to work out a way for somebody to license all these patents together took longer than developing the standard. And the people from the JPEG Standards Committee now say that prospective standardization is nearly impossible because of software patents. They're trying to develop a standard that people are free to use, and they can't. In 2004, Bill Gates showed us why he had been talking so much about how he was going to solve the spam problem. Microsoft proposed an internet standard, which it turns out they had applied for a patent on, and they released a license showing what their policy would be for using this technique. And the license policy essentially said, free software forbidden. No program implementing this technique could come with permission to redistribute. I wasn't surprised. I began expecting that as soon as I heard Gates hyping the issue. I figured he would use this to try to grab control of the internet. Well, that standard proposal was rejected. And Microsoft said that they would talk to a few major ISPs to try to make it a de facto standard anyway. We'll have to see what the outcome is. So there are patents that you just can't avoid because they're necessary to implement the standards that people demand. Sometimes what's patented is a feature. Then the way you avoid the patent is don't implement the feature. For instance, the progress bar is patented. Well, you could make your program not display progress bars. It's going to be somewhat more less appealing to the users, but they might still use it. At one point, the users of the word processor Xyrite received a downgrade in the mail. Xyrite formerly had a feature where you could define abbreviations, and then when you type the abbreviation followed by punctuation, it would automatically expand into some other string you had chosen. And then they found out that somebody had a patent on this. So they tried to negotiate a license, but they found out that he kept changing his demands. So eventually they gave up talking to him and they said, we'll take the feature out. And they sent their users a downgrade. Now how did I find out about this? Well, they wrote to me because they'd heard that the text editor Emacs had a similar feature in the 1970s. So they asked if I could help them to overturn this patent. And indeed, eventually the patent was overturned a number of years later, and partly on the strength of my work. So it's nice to know I've had at least one patentable idea in my life. But it's not nice to find out through someone else's patenting it. And I'm glad that my work helped get rid of that patent. That's one patent down and hundreds of thousands to go. Sometimes a patent is so broad you can't possibly avoid it. For instance, the entire field of public key encryption was covered by a very broad patent in the U.S. and was essentially off limits to everyone for many years. Well, that's avoiding the patent. Sometimes you can. Sometimes it's feasible. Sometimes it's too painful. You know, if it's just a matter of avoiding features, well, you leave out one feature, people may still think your program's good enough to use. You leave out 10 features, at that point they're going to start saying, well, this program is inferior, look at all the things it doesn't have. Well, what about getting a license to use the patent? Well, the first thing is, this is not necessarily an option. The patent holder doesn't have to offer a license. The patent holder can say, I'm shutting you down. I don't want to let you make this program. I once got a letter asking for help from someone whose family business was making casino games, computerized, of course. And he was being threatened by a patent holder that was demanding that he shut his business down. So he showed me the patent. And claim number one was rather interesting. It claims a network of multiple computers where each computer supports more than one game, and each computer can show more than one game session at a time. That's it. I'm sure that in the 1980s, there were various colleges that set up networks of workstations that had Windows systems on them. Not Microsoft Windows, some kind of Windows system. And that they installed multiple games, and as a result, were doing what this patent covered. And they didn't think they'd invented anything. They were just using the available things in a natural way. But you see, the patent office believes that if somebody did something once, and then this guy makes a machine that'll do it N times, that's an invention. The patent office believes that if people have done A and B, and somebody else makes a thing that will do either A or B, that's an invention. We call them the while statement and the switch statement, but for the patent office, these are inventions. You've got to realize, every time they issue a patent on something broad and obvious like this, they say, well, yes, there are always going to be a few bad apples, and that's a lie, because these things happen systematically because of the nature of their system. It's not because patent examiners are stupid. It's because they are rushed and they're following rules. And these rules make it a lot easier to accept these patents than to reject them. They'd have to come up with a specific justification for rejecting them, and it's a lot more work, and they don't have time. And they'd have to follow the rules, and the rules set the threshold so low that you get things like this. Anyway, ridiculous as that patent was, we couldn't help him. And he shut his business. Most patent holders, however, will offer you a license, but it's likely to cost. The natural order recalculation patent was being licensed for 5% of the sales price of a spreadsheet. Now, maybe you could afford one such patent license. But what happens if you have to get 20 of them? And then what about when yet another patent holder shows up? Well, this is actually just an absurdity. People in business told me that practically speaking, two or three of them would be enough to make your business fail. But there are some software developers that can very easily and painlessly get licenses most of the time. Those are the multinational megacorporations, because they have thousands of patents, and they cross-license each other. So all of them end up with licenses to almost all the patents that matter. So they're safe most of the time. They make an exclusive club. They're up there at the top of this cliff, and we're all at the bottom, with no chance of getting up there. And this is very important to understand, because this is what refutes the myth that the patent system, quote, protects, unquote, the, quote, small inventor, unquote. It's not true, and let me show you why. They present a scenario. It's, you might say, the starving genius scenario. They say, imagine that there's a brilliant designer of whatever who has spent years working in his attic perfecting a new method of doing whatever, and now it's working, so he's going to take this one idea and make it into a product. And then it's going to be a great success. His business would be a tremendous success, except for one thing. The big companies will compete with him, and they will take away all of the customers. Not just most of them. And his company will fail because of that, and then he'll starve. Now, this is a series of unlikely assumptions. I won't say this never happens, but it's rare. So rare, it's not even worth thinking about, really. But nonetheless, I'll think about it anyway, because I want to show you that their conclusions are wrong. So what's unlikely here? First of all, in high-tech fields, progress doesn't usually come from people working in isolation. It comes from people working in the community, in projects, not in their attics usually. And the next thing is that in the software field, a useful program isn't one idea. So he may have developed a good way to do one particular thing. Now that idea may be very useful when combined with thousands of other ideas to make a large program, but it's not of any use by itself most of the time. It's only of use when it's combined with other ideas. But now, let's forget that. Let's assume he makes this product and the only idea in this product is his. Well, actually, it's not going to be. The point is that, so he's going to make a product and it's going to combine his idea with lots of other ideas. So now let's assume the next assumption is it going to be a success? Well, just because he's good at engineering doesn't mean he knows how to run a business. So, and the fact is, most new businesses fail. I think in the U.S. it's over 90% fail within 5 years. So probably it's not going to succeed, and it has nothing to do with the big companies. He just probably doesn't know how to run it. But let's assume he does know how to run a business as well. It's another unlikely assumption, but we can make it. Now, suppose the big companies compete with him. Does that mean they get all of the business? Not necessarily. After all, there are lots of small businesses out there. Most of the new ones fail, but that still leaves a lot that succeed. And small businesses have some disadvantages and some advantages. If he knows how to run a business, he'll utilize the advantages of a small business. He doesn't need to get most of the market in order to be a success. He only needs to get some. So he might, if he does know how to run a business, he may yet succeed. So we're making one more unlikely assumption, which is that in fact, despite knowing how to run a business, he still fails, and it's because of competition from the big companies. At this point, what's going to happen to him? Is he going to starve? Well, if he's that good at engineering and knows how to run a business, I'm sure he can get a job. So a whole series of unlikely assumptions, but let's make them anyway. This myth says that the patent system will, quote, protect, unquote, our genius, because he will get a patent. And then when IBM wants to compete with him, he'll say, oh no, IBM, you can't compete with me because I've got this patent. And IBM says, not again. And just slinks off and does nothing. Here's what really happens. IBM practices cross-licensing. IBM published an article in Think Magazine, issue number 5, 1990, about IBM's patent portfolio. It said that IBM got two kinds of benefits from its 9,000 active U.S. patents. That number is obsolete. Now it's 40,000. But the two benefits were, first of all, collecting money, and second, gaining access to the patents of others through cross-licensing. And the article said that the second benefit was, quote, perhaps an order of magnitude greater, unquote, than the first. In other words, they're saying 10 times, the benefit of cross-licensing was 10 times the value of the money they collect. But what's the benefit of cross-licensing? Gaining access to the patents of others. In other words, they escape from most of the problem of patents. Others might have patents, but that doesn't hurt IBM because IBM makes them cross-license. And what IBM is saying is that the problems they avoid in this way are 10 times as big as the money they collect. So when our genius says to IBM, you can't compete with me, I've got this patent, what IBM really says is, oh, you have a patent, how nice. We have this patent and this one and this one and this one and this one, each of which covers something else going on in your product. Something that's in there in addition to your new idea. And if you think you can fight all these in court, we'll just pull out some more. So sign a cross license with us and then nobody has to get hurt. So our genius, who we've assumed understands business, realizes he has no choice and he signs the cross license and they shake hands and IBM says, thank you, now we can compete with you. So the patent system doesn't, quote, protect, unquote, our starving genius at all. It doesn't work. The thing is just a myth. Now, there are occasions when even IBM can't manage to do cross-licensing. You see, some patents, IBM can only make the patent holder cross-license if